Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Whiskey Congress is back in session. We do not have Steven with us. Steven is off celebrating his birthday. So happy birthday, brother. I look forward to seeing you soon. But stepping in for him is our friend Ben from My Whiskey Den. My Whiskey Den typically runs 9 p.m. on Mondays on their YouTube channel. They were nice enough to have me on about, I don't know, 3-4 weeks ago. I had a great time and got a little tuned up on drinking multiple craft American whiskeys. And so Ben is responsible for that, I suppose. No, I'm responsible for my own damn actions. And anyway, so thank you for coming on. Great to have you here. And, you know, so Ben is calling in from Anderson, South Carolina, the birthplace of Chadwick Boseman, who passed away sadly. Yeah. Steve is a huge fan of Chadwick Boseman, so when we get together again, we're going to talk about that in some detail, but I did want to acknowledge the passing of a really impressive actor who hid his illness through some pretty tough stuff and managed to still be a working actor despite being obviously seriously ill. Yeah. So on that cheery note, Ben, thank you. Thanks for coming on, and welcome.
Thanks for having me. I really am honored by the invite here, so looking forward to the conversation today.
So when do we get the next episode of My Whiskey Den?
We normally shoot, we have a live stream on Mondays, typically at 9, but we are actually going live tonight at 9:30. We're going to compare cigars with some whiskey pairings, and specifically looking at one called Tomstown out of Kansas City. We're going to compare before and after the impacts of a cigar with the whiskey tasting.
So. Oh, nice. That should be interesting. So I can't even say this. The scotch you gave me.
Bunahabin.
Bunahabin 18-year-old scotch is phenomenal. Holy shit, this is good. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right, man. So I hate that we do this every week, but we have to, because every week Trump does something that you just can't ignore. And I think this is a really telling one, because unidentified sources have said that Trump, while in France, chose not to visit a World War I cemetery where 2,000 Marines, I believe around 2,000 Marines, were interred.
Right.
And he allegedly, the accusations are that he didn't want to go there because it was raining and he didn't want it to mess up his hair, which is amazing, and that he called, that he said he didn't want to go visit that place because it's filled with losers.
Yeah.
And then he later called departed soldiers suckers. Now, he's, of course, denying this, saying no president has ever done more for the military than me. I've got some serious thoughts on this, but as our guest, I'll let you go first.
Okay. Yeah. kind of funny that he seems to always say that he's done more for pretty much every people group in America, right?
Yeah.
But no, to me, the timing of the article... Unnamed sources always have an issue with unnamed sources. To me, it's kind of cheap journalism, if you will. And it's clearly an attack piece, in my opinion. But, hey, that's been going on since, you know, Thomas Jefferson was in office. You know, the media using it for political purposes, et cetera. But you also have the problem with this. You have Jennifer Griffin from Fox News, who says she has confirmed the sources personally. And then you look at Trump's past statements, especially considering John McCain and prisoners of war from Vietnam, and it is not a far stretch at all to imagine that he would make this kind of statement. My question is, what kind of impact is this going to have with his supporters? You know, obviously you got your hardcore MAGA types. Trump can do no wrong. He can say no wrong. He can deny this till the cows come home, and he probably will. And there's a lot of people that will believe him. I have a little bit of a hard time with it just because of the anonymous sources issue. But again, it's hard not to just dismiss it outright either, because again, statements he's made before, this is right in line with things he's already said. So you know, is this going to really hurt him politically? And the article came out, Jeffrey Goldberg, The Atlantic, you know, just for clarity, I'm an Atlantic subscriber. I've read them for years just to get different perspective, you know, and they've been very much an anti-Trump media source since he was running for office, you know, back before 2016. So they've really gone after him hard, Goldberg especially. But yeah, so.
See, well, the other thing is, I heard him say relatively recently, I think as this story was coming out, that I never called John McCain a loser. I'm like, dude, I heard you say it. You tweeted it. It's in a fucking record.
Right.
So a denial from Trump means nothing to me. I agree that the media, I frankly don't know much about The Atlantic. But, you know, if you subscribe to it, read it regularly, I absolutely trust your assessment. And it is part of the problem with the media today, especially revolving around Trump, because it is such a hostile environment. Now, when you call the media fake news, you can't expect them to say, oh, thanks for your insights. Let's try to change and work together. But at the same time, the media shouldn't eschew its job just because he was mean to me. I mean, Trump does they were mean to me, so I'm going to be a jerk to them all the time. And the media doing the same thing in return is a, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. Now, the nature of this article is not just, well, sorry, I'm totally fumbling over what I'm trying to say. But this article in particular, which I did not fully read, that, like you said, is not out of character. The people who don't like Trump are going to not like him. I remember what I want to say now. So another story that came out of the media this week is Trump asking voters. The headline was Trump asks voters to vote twice in North Carolina, which is not really what he did. And I'm not defending Trump. I'm defending a principle here, that he said something that was basically like, I don't trust the election system. So why don't you test that system by doing this and see if the system truly does work and limit one person to one vote. That's what I believe he was trying to say. He said it rather awkwardly, but the media immediately went on attack mode and said, you know, Trump encourages North Carolinians to break the law. That's a misrepresentation, and it's sloppy journalism. And when you do shit like that, just like I'm saying, I don't believe Trump's denials at all, because I have documentation of him lying about shit. I never called John McCain a loser. Here's a tweet of me calling John McCain a loser. Here's a video of me calling McCain a loser. So this is one of those things where I think everyone can be at fault here. I think the North Carolina voting story was just it was a hit piece that didn't really even have legs. It just it sounded good. It was a catchy headline, and it drew clicks, I'm sure. And unfortunately, that's become the role of the goal of the media, and it should not be the goal of the media or the role of the media. Look at me using words that sound the same. So
yeah, I think probably part of the problem with the media is right now, they're gunning for headlines, they're gunning for clicks, they're gunning for, you know, to get that attention, to break that story first. And so the, you know, there's a tendency, it seems, and it just seems to be ramping up more and more while Trump has been in office, is to use anonymous sources. And some of these have come back to bite the media over the last couple of years since Trump's been in office. They've tried to break a story quickly. We quote an anonymous source as this, and then it turns out, you know, I think there's been a few instances where it turns out to be totally wrong. So again, it's one of these, I would just love to see actual real journalism. Let's dig in. Let's get real sources. Let's cite it. I mean, when I was looking into this a little bit, even CNN a while back had posted an article or a story about how to not fall for their ideal of fake news. And like three of those, the points they made was, you know, making sure the story has properly cited sources, that you have traceable quotes, et cetera. So here we are with a story that really does not have traceable quotes or a cited source. So you're just left to, you know, well, do you believe it or do you not believe it? And a lot of that probably tends to fall on what your political leanings are to begin with. So
right. I mean, the whole thing about confirmation bias is a very real thing.
Yep.
And I'm sure that's why you read The Atlantic. It's why I watch OAN and Fox, because I want to see, okay, what's getting said on this channel. And OAN, by the way, is a trip. You ever watch OAN? Yeah. It's awesome.
I have a few times.
It, at times it reminds me of the news station in V for Vendetta. Yeah. I mean, which I'm trying to be funny, but in another way, it's really scary. I mean, it is the difference between V for Vendetta and what we have now is we do have other outlets and they're not all controlled by the government, and OAN is not controlled by the government. It just recognizes that there's money in being all the way up Trump's ass, so they do it all the time. I saw another ad for Trumpy Bear, which we've talked about on the show in the past. Have you ever seen Trumpy Bear?
No, I've not seen the ad, but I heard you guys talk about it.
Okay, I mean, literally, it has an American flag blanket that you stuff up the ass of a bear, and these are the people who are claiming that they honor the American flag. I don't know the flag code, but I do know one thing you're not supposed to do is wear it.
That and shove it up the ass of a bear.
And shove it up the ass of a stuffed bear, also not considered part of the code. All right. One thing also, so you and I interact quite a bit on Facebook, which is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And one thing I put out there the other day, because I'm tired of every time I open an app getting Chuck Schumer to pop up and say, we have, you know, a critical deadline, and if you donate now, it'll be matched $3 to 1. I'm like, what is this, a fucking telethon? If you can match it 3 to 1, put your 3 in and leave me alone. I'm well aware that money wins elections, and I really wish there've been a few exceptions where, like, not, I don't want to talk politics wise. Just AOC is kind of a phenomenon in the fact that she did not have a bunch of money. She is very progressive, whether you agree with her views or not. You have to give her credit for unseating an incumbent Democrat and doing it with relatively little funding. But I believed for a long time that we just need to get campaign contributions, especially shady, unidentified campaign contributions, out of the system. I think that if you're running for the House of Representatives, you basically run for that job, get that job, get sworn in, and then you're right back onto the campaign trail, or the contribution trail, because in 2 years, you need to get elected again. And I have to believe the people doing those jobs would rather not be doing that. And I'll bet you can do it a whole lot better if you're not constantly begging people for the money to help you to continue to do your job or get back into your job. So I would love to see campaign contributions just eliminated. I would like to see, and here's where we might part ways, an increased tax of some kind that gets distributed equally to all parties running. And I don't know how you do that with third parties and whatnot, but I'm confident that we have the ability to do that. We love to say this. We put a man on the moon. We can figure this shit out. And I think it's also, in addition to being a good thing to do in terms of, you know, changing the structure of what drives politics, meaning money from individuals with agendas, it would also give everyone an equal playing field to start and kind of give them a chance to show how will they manage money. Because if you want me to vote for you and you're out of money 3 weeks before the election, maybe I don't want you handling my country's money.
Right. So, I come from a more libertarian stance. I don't like taxes at all. But I'm willing to hear this out because at the same time, I'm with you. I'm sick to death of basically we elect a president. They do their job for 2 years and they spend the next 2 years running for the next election, basically. Right. And it's just and it goes for pretty much every elected office you see. And I'd even put this, talking about social media, I threw this on Facebook the other day. Within 10 minutes time, I had 3 different texts. So I don't watch a lot of TV. I mean, my TV is, you know, Netflix or something like that. So political ads on TV don't get to me much. But I get them by spam text all the time. And so maybe this is past involvement in Republican Party in years past. I'm independent. I'm a libertarian now. But so within the span of 10 minutes, I had a text from the South Carolina Democratic Party asking me to be a poll watcher from Ted, quote unquote, Ted Cruz asking for contributions to the RNC. And then another text from Joe Jorgensen for libertarian candidate asking for donations. And I get this all day long, every day, and it drives me crazy. So I'm curious to hear this out, but here's, I guess, in thinking about this a little bit, if you restrict donations or you cut off campaign contributions, my first response is, well, basically this means only the wealthy will run because they're going to try to, they can self-finance a campaign, a person like Trump, a person like Bloomberg, et cetera. So the average man is a little bit handicapped. I think what you would have to do is say, if you were to pass a tax on this, here's the money. This is the money you can run on and nothing else. You cannot use your own funds. You can't use any funds from anywhere else. Here's a government provided funds for the campaign. And that's it. That's all you get to run on.
I agree with that.
Go at it.
And free public access debates, I think, would be a good thing, especially at the local level. In the world we're in today, you know, the world has changed so much since these systems were put into place. It is so easy to reach people, whether they want to be reached or not, per the story you just told. And it's so much easier to get information. I've never bought into the notion that if I'm against the Electoral College, although I can understand the arguments on both sides of it. But the idea that people will only campaign where there's a lot of people doesn't, to me, that doesn't matter anymore. Even if I was the world's biggest Biden supporter, which I'm not, I'm not a hater, but I'm certainly not the biggest fan by any means. But even if I were a Biden supporter and he were to come to Cleveland to speak, I wouldn't go. I'd watch the thing. Right. I don't need to stand in a crowd. I don't need to, you know, I can see it on my TV, listen with my own two ears. Kind of like with football. If I hear something that's weird, I can pause it and go, wait, what was that? And rewind it. So I don't believe that if people didn't have the ability to appear in person in campaign rally, that it would hurt them as much. Having said that, the data suggests I'm wrong. I mean, everyone says if Hillary had been more diligent in her ground game and gone to Michigan and gone to Wisconsin and gone to Pennsylvania, it might have made a difference. And I guess the key is it might not make a difference to someone like me or you who wants to be informed, but somebody who gets caught up in a bit of celebrity and says, oh, you know, candidate X came to my hometown and went to it probably does sway the 10% that otherwise might not know. So I just convinced myself that my own argument was garbage.
Right. Well, I mean, and you do. You have, there's a certain element of the public that's always going to be swayed by charisma. You know, Obama had fantastic charisma, great speaker, and that impacted a lot of people and their decisions. Quite honestly, Hillary, you know, this is my take. She could have gone out there as much as she wanted to. I don't know that she had the charisma to sway that many more voters to her side.
I agree.
In a lot of those states. I mean, she honestly, I could sit and listen to Bill Clinton all day long.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, watching him in the last two DNCs, the conventions, he's like grandpa sitting around a fireplace telling tall tales. And you know what? That's great. Hillary gets up, her cadence, her speech, just everything. I just want to plug my ears and go away. Sorry.
But no, I'm with you. Hillary to me came off as utterly disingenuous. I mean, she's just not a genuine human being, and she does a terrible job of hiding it. Biden is really a pretty awkward speaker. Now, what's funny to me is after he gave his DNC speech, the talk was, well, anyone can use a teleprompter. Anyone can use a teleprompter. Well, not anyone. Because there's a guy occupying the White House right now who called Yosemite National Park Yosemite. So I was talking to a friend about this, and they were like, there's no way he doesn't know what Yosemite is. I'm like, there's absolutely a way. He doesn't give a shit. He's an East Coast elitist, and I've been in those crowds, and it's amazing how they think the world stops 10 miles west of where they are. And I mean, if it doesn't have a golf course on it or a resort on it, I guarantee you he's never been to Yosemite. And just to be fair, this is not even, I mean, I am directing this at Trump and I am calling him an East Coast elitist because he is, but he's not the only one who's prone to this. The most famous example is John Kerry going to Green Bay and saying it's great to be here at Lambert Stadium.
Right.
I mean,
don't mess that up. In Green Bay,
right. Exactly. You're trying to go relate to people and tell them I'm one of you. Hillary came to Buffalo in 2006, I believe it was, and the Sabres were playing the Carolina Hurricanes in the playoffs, and they were like one win away from going to the Stanley Cup Finals. Hillary gets up there and says, and when we win this game, we're going to the Stanley Cup playoffs. No, dingbat, we've been in the playoffs for three rounds. This is the finals. And again, people in that lifestyle do not relate to normal people. And when they try to pretend they do, they suck at it. That's actually why I think Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were such good orators and why they connected with people is they both grew up poor. And I think, you know, when you've had to deal with being, you know, making choices about whether you buy the generic bread or the fancy stuff and you choose generic because that $2 difference matters in your life, it's a little different than growing up in golf clubs and country clubs. So anyway, that's a little sidetrack, but the Yosemite thing cracked me up, and the whole he's only good because of the teleprompter, which was originally said about Obama, which I think had some racist tones to it, but we'll save that for another time. So anyway, you want to move on?
I'll throw this out here, Jim. If you're going down that route of you're going to limit or you're going to eliminate campaign contributions, do you start down the road? Because this is, I guess this is a debate and a talk I've had with friends locally. Do you start down the road the idea of eliminating or banning political parties? Because part of the problem you're dealing with, you eliminate campaign contributions. Well, you've got to deal with the fact that you've got money in the Senate and the Congress with each party that they have a big treasure chest to help their incumbents get reelected. And that's, I think a lot of people don't realize. So I'll just use an example. Here in South Carolina, in Anderson, we have, a guy running for Congress. He's a good conservative, young guy, wants to go in there. I'm going to make change. I'm going to make waves in Congress, right? They get elected. They go up there. What's the first thing they do? They sit them down, and basically you're told you're going to toe the party line. You're going to do what we say, exactly what we say, because if you don't, we're not going to appoint you to any committees, and we're not going to support you for reelection. And so that's why we see people get elected, touting change, and then they go to Washington, and nothing changes, nothing happens. And so if you want to break that kind of stranglehold, if you will, over individuals trying to bring an actual voice for their electorate to Washington, do you begin to break and destroy, or basically destroy political parties, if you will? Do you ban that?
That's an interesting point. And what you just described, by the way, Tulsi Gabbard, when she was on Joe Rogan's podcast, said literally, they sat me down and said, and right. here's the status quo, and here's why we're keeping it, and you play nice and keep your mouth shut. And that is a big part of the problem. And then, you know what? Maybe I should get off my contribution reform thing and focus more on redistricting, because the way that Congress has set up its ability to maintain its stranglehold, I think is the word you just used, a lot of that has to do with congressional districts. And I don't know what California did with their congressional districts under Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I know that was one of his big things, and he's probably a guy that I would want to be put in charge of that. You know, he does not have a current political agenda. He's not eligible to run for president. Asking him what they did in California, because I think they did shake up the incumbent reelection rate in California. I'm basing that on a Schwarzenegger speech from years ago. So there's been a lot of whiskey between now and then. So I don't want to say that I'm getting that exactly right. But maybe that's the more important, if you're going to take on a cause, changing districts so that they're not guaranteed strangleholds for a given candidate or a given party is really what they are. Because right now, the only way congressional members of Congress lose their jobs is if they get beat in a primary. So if you're in a really conservative primary, you just got to be that much more crazy conservative than the next guy. And if you're a Democrat, you have to read the room, as comics say. Some districts are very moderate and progressives like AOC have no chance. And some districts are begging for, change and would say that AOC doesn't go far enough. I don't know why I'm talking about her so much. She's such a lightning rod for the right. And whenever my friends come at me about this, I'm like, I don't really care what a freshman congresswoman from New York is doing. She's good for her. Go do you. But you're one of 400 and some people in a chamber, and you're not representing the district I'm in. So say what you want. Do what you want. I just care about, doing the right thing. And unlike most of these folks, kind of to your point, she actually does seem to be trying to reform things now. Is she going to succeed? No, because she's a freshman congresswoman from New York, and the establishment is going to, keep her playing and stay quiet in the corner. So
I mean, she's had her idiotic statements, and I'll give her that, but I don't write her off either, because the girl got elected. Like you said, she ran a campaign against a very entrenched incumbent, and she got in there. Is she very progressive and, as you said, a lightning rod? Yes. And the fact that conservatives, especially like Fox News and groups like that, want to focus on her so much, guess what? You're making her the celebrity that she is.
Right. Absolutely.
If you're so adamantly opposed to her ideas and what she's for, then ignore her and leave her alone and nobody will ever hear about her, basically.
Right.
But at the same time, I guess that's for me politically is what I do appreciate about her very much is she does have a big push for reform. And there's a number of things that she has said that I've gone, I didn't think I would agree with AOC, but I absolutely agree with this. And I've, you know, retweeted it and shared it because, you know what, it's just the right thing to do, regardless of whether you like the person or not. That's my take on her. Yeah. Do I agree with her all the time? Most of the time, no. But sometimes there's some ideas and things she has that really need to be heard. So
your consistency in ignoring political parties and just focusing ideas is something I genuinely admire and appreciate because it's the rarity in the world today. I'm sorry to say. I mean, I had a fight with I've got a friend from Buffalo who is very conservative, generally doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about, and he'll send me little, you know, jab emails and usually AOC said this or whatever. And right. I just texted him the other day. So he's a troll, he's an instigator and just always trying to push buttons. So I did kind of the same thing in reverse to him not too long ago, a couple days ago. And I texted him and said, if that Trump story about saying that about soldiers ends up getting verified by reliable sources, will that change your, will you still vote for him? And he replied, if you're going to be asking questions like this, I don't know if a friendship can stand it. So let's stop talking politics, which I will call checkmate on.
Yeah.
But literally, you know, so people are so entrenched and you know, there are Republicans that I've supported. I was living in Massachusetts when Mitt Romney ran for governor and I was a Romney guy. And it was largely because of the way the Democrats just went out attacking him in his primary. And I'm like, you're attacking him because you're afraid of him. You're afraid of him because you might lose to him. And you did. Right. So
well,
anyway,
and I was going to say, and I'm with you, Tulsi Gabbard. I voted for her in the primary. And if she had won the primary, I'd be voting for her in the general election.
OK. Yeah. So. That was my girl. I was really bummed and kind of in the same vein of what you said. I think Tulsi was told, yeah, your message isn't going to resonate with us. And I think they worked very hard to keep her quiet.
Right.
In 2016, I was furious when Gary Johnson and Jill Stein weren't allowed to enter the debate. The Republican primaries had 16 people on stage at one point, I think. When the actual presidential election came on, you could have put Gary Johnson and Jill Stein up there. And I think they would have dramatically shifted the vote had people heard from them. All you heard was, she's a wackadoo liberal and he's a crazy Republican who talks about putting his hand up the skirt of the Statue of Liberty, which he did say.
Yeah.
So not that Gary Johnson wasn't good for some quotes, but Donald Trump said grab him by the pussy and got elected. So I'm going to say that that should not have disqualified him. And yes, I just realized the image I just put in people's heads, and I apologize for that. So what got us to get to know each other was you and Steve interacting and Steve coming on your panel. You've done a lot of roundtable talks, mostly revolving around policing and the effect of policing on race or race on policing, however you want to say it. And first of all, I appreciate you doing that. I've watched a bunch of your discussions and they're always good. You then sent Steve and I a story that happened down in your neck of the woods, and I'd like to kind of turn it over to you because this is a story of a police shooting that has not gotten a lot of attention, and I think it shines a few spotlights, so I'll throw the ball into your court.
Sure. So
actually, let me interrupt right away. I also started the Bushmills 21. I just meant to get that in first.
Oh, that's a fantastic whiskey. Enjoy. Tuesday, August 11th is when this went down. And when the story broke, you first read it and you thought, okay, typical kind of police interaction here, dealt with a couple of bad characters. And unfortunately, a canine was killed in the process, police canine. And I really didn't think anything more about it. And then days later, more details start to come and the story completely shifts and completely changes. So it was Tuesday, August 11th. It was in the evening at night around 10 o'clock. A couple was driving down one of the main thoroughfares here in our city in Anderson and driving recklessly. I guess they were reported. Police pursued them. They broke the pursuit when they got into city limits and hit some traffic. And then they shortly got a call later that they had collided with a cab, They jumped out of the car, took off into a little wooded area near a shopping center. The police pursued with the canine, and in short order, they opened fire. The initial story was that the couple ran into the woods, and the words ambush were used. They set up an ambush for the police, and two deputies pursued with the canine. They reported they were shot at, so they opened fire, and multiple shots on both sides. The canine was shot and killed by the suspects. The lead suspect, his name was Brian Keith Hamilton Jr. He was 21. He was shot and killed, and his passenger that was with him was a female, 16 years old. She's not really been identified. She was also wounded in the interaction, had to be flown out to the hospital for treatment. But within a few days, the story really began to shift. And so what they then began to share was, well, the individual, Brian Hamilton Jr., did not open fire on the police. He shot himself in the head. It was a single shot. And when the officers heard that single shot, they opened fire, killing their own canine. So initially it was first reported that the canine was killed by the offenders here, but no, they killed their own canine. Also, the female, she was shot in the neck, missing a toe, which I'm assuming was shot off, had a broken leg in the process, and they brought her out in handcuffs. According to reports here, the medics on the scene had to convince the officers to, you know, release her from the handcuffs so they could begin to treat her. She is now being represented by two prominent lawyers, one locally here, Bakari Sellers. He was a former state legislator here in South Carolina, and Ben Crump, who's also with the George Floyd family, representing the George Floyd family. So some prominent attorneys here. Now, what has not been made aware in the news story is the race of the people involved. Really don't know. I saw the obituary for Brian Hamilton Jr. Honestly, the picture's not great. I can't really tell. White or Latino, the female, I have no idea. They're just from locally here. But I don't know. There's a lot. I'll let you jump in and offer your takes on this, and I can give mine. But, you know, to me, this just speaks volumes about, I think, really the lack of training and some other issues that go on with police in this as well.
So. No, I agree. And that's what sometimes there's a blurred line between what is, a malignant action and what is just bad training and bad performance. I've gotten in fights with 100 people over Tamir Rice. I don't know if you know the story from Cleveland, 12-year-old boy with the toy gun. Horrible story. The cop was completely incompetent. There was a bunch of reasons he should have never been there. But when people say he murdered Tamir Rice, I'm like, you know, he was a cop responding to a call of a young man menacing people with a gun. He shows up, there's a gun there. He handled it. The cop handled it horribly. He subsequently lost his job. But, you know, I'm completely not defending the actions and I'm saying flat out the training is hideous. Having said that, I don't believe he should have been criminally charged. I'm about to say something really, really unpopular, because no one has been done wrong more than Breonna Taylor. She was literally at home in bed. The only thing she did wrong is she dated a scumbag who she was no longer dating and got lumped in by association. And if making bad decisions and dating was a reason to get shot, I'd look like Sonny at the toll booth. So I've been waiting to get that line in all day, I got to be honest. But you know, in that case, police were jumping into what they believed was a hostile situation. They were shot at. They shot back. Very likely poor training, and maybe there was some criminal activity. I mean, I don't know all the details, but people want to compare Breonna Taylor to George Floyd. I can't go there. You know, it's a totally different situation. So in this case in South Carolina, what I'm hearing is it sounds like they acted, based on what I read from the story, it sounded like the two suspects fled into the woods, chased by the dog. I don't know if the dog, physically got to them and attacked them or not, or just had them at bay. The
dog did have the female.
Okay.
Is what was reported. He had a hold of the female. So,
which makes me wonder more why she ended up getting shot, because if she was getting thrashed by a dog, she was and was unarmed. There's hardly less threatening of a person than someone who probably doesn't weigh as much as the German Shepherd that's throwing them around. And then the other suspect was, like I said, shot himself, one shot and done. trying to be fair. I mean, I got to imagine if you're in that situation, you're chasing someone, it's dark, you hear a gunshot, it's got to be terrifying. But there's also got to be a way to train people better than that, because this keeps happening. You know, we talk on the show about this sort of stuff all the time, and the number is something like there's, you know, 1,000 police shootings a year, which compared to the general population is a very small number. On the other hand, that also, based on my math, is roughly 20 a week. So 20 times a week. So if we, you know, when we do the show, I would love to be talking about something else. I'd love to be talking about positive stuff, but we can't escape police shootings. And I gotta say, the current cocktail is really, really dangerous, because right now everyone just is looking for a reason to get to the streets. And then once people are on the streets, mostly with good intentions, then you get the people with bad intentions. And it takes a very small fraction of people with bad intentions to make things go from, you know, peaceful to a disaster. I mean, I always make this comment with football fans, because people say, I went to a Bills, I'm a Bills fan, so I went to the Bills game, the Bills fans were assholes, fuck those people. I'm like, I understand why you feel that way, because you pack 70,000 people into a stadium. If 1% of them are assholes, that's 7,000 assholes.
Exactly.
No, it's 700. But anyway, but still, it's a large number.
I can't remember. I'm a math atheist.
Okay, and it's 700. 7,000 would be 10%. But anyway, but frankly, 10% of fans are typically assholes. And if 1% is, if there's 700 people in a concentrated area that want to cause trouble, they can. And when they think they can do it anonymously, it gets a whole lot worse. So I don't know, I'm kind of derailing the subject, but, you know, it doesn't take a lot of bad apples to ruin the whole thing. And when you get these, when you get these protests going and they turn into a riot, things get out of control. And now you've got people on the right clashing with people on the left. And some guy in Portland was apparently identifying himself as Antifa, which I've argued many times is just sort of a made up boogeyman that now people seem to be adopting, but that's a different discussion also. So I don't know what the solution is in terms of that, but I mean, fortunately in Anderson, you're not having people march down the streets and burning shit, at least as far as I know.
Yeah, not so far. I mean, there were some marches going on when George Floyd happened, and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and all that broke loose, but they stayed relatively peaceful. The sheriff here, I know him. I grew up with him, went to school with him, went to church with him. We worked together at a job before. He was a state trooper for a number of years before he ran for the office of sheriff here. And to his credit, you know, the sheriff's office here in Anderson had been largely very corrupt for a number of years. And he came in and he's taken an approach to really try to clean that up. But this is the kind of thing that, you know, I have concern about is, okay, are we going to see the next George Floyd here? Because you never know where this is going to happen. And Steve and I have had this kind of conversation before in talking about when you're getting pulled over by police, everybody wants to say, well, you know, there's a few bad apples. But when you're being pulled over, you're being stopped, you don't know who those bad apples are.
Right.
And it's your life on the line.
Right. And I mean,
you know, as Steve has thrown out, if you don't comply, you die. Is that really a legitimate, you know, way we want to do things? And I think that's what I have a serious question about. And looking at this situation, officers hear one shot, and look, I've done a lot of training with firearms. Now, I haven't been in the military. I'm not a law enforcement guy, but I'm a big gun guy. I've done a lot of training with firearms. And the way I was trained for me is, you know, you hear a shot, you take cover and you assess the situation and figure out what's going on before you return fire. This happened at 10:15 at night, which I can tell you is very dark here in Anderson right now, this time of year. So you're in the dark in the woods, you hear one shot, and you just open fire?
Right. You probably don't know. I mean, what are you shooting at?
Exactly. And then what? You
in this case, you're shooting at your own dog.
Right. And there you go. As well as you're also, this area, this was a small patch of woods in one of the main thoroughfares here. So there's a lot of businesses, a lot of shopping centers and whatnot around. You know, where are those bullets going?
Yeah. I mean,
you know, I'm like the whole Breonna Taylor situation.
Yeah.
So it raises a lot of questions and concerns. And I know I have friends in the sheriff's department in the next county here. We've talked about training. He oversaw the firearms training for his division there. And, you know, I'm not named. Here you go. Anonymous sources. But His statement was that you would be surprised how lax a lot of the officers are with their firearms training. They do just enough to meet their qualification every 6 months, and that's it. He said, I work my butt off to try to get these guys into the range and practicing and training and shooting and keeping up, you know, with what they're being taught and what they're being trained. So with that said, yeah, you know what? Yeah, I think we could invest and we could do a lot better with getting these guys trained up to do a better job, and it would save more lives, ours and theirs.
Right. You know. Right. I agree with you completely. Have you seen any of these videos? I can't open my Facebook now without a video popping up of some guy, always a white guy, well, not always, but, you know, basically getting pulled over and getting asked for ID and saying, I don't have to show you an ID. What did I do wrong? And I'm very torn on this because, first of all, this is where doing that kind of shit, I think, makes the job of the police that much harder. Yeah. You know, just getting agitated and poked with a stick and being told, you know, people acting like they're constitutional lawyers. Now, it's amazing how many officers don't actually know the law and don't know they can't just pull you over and start searching your car. You know, I don't know the exact answer, but I do know that the system we got right now is not working great. And I think more training and more respect on both directions should be out there. I understand it's a dangerous job to be a cop. Also, you got a badge and a gun, and you have the right, if I do something that you deem to be illegal, to just take my freedom away from me and let those court systems straighten it out. So with that power comes the responsibility of being a public servant, not just I'm in a bad mood and I've got an ego and, you know, so-and-so looked at me wrong. And being a 40-something white guy, I don't deal with nearly as much shit as most of my black friends have dealt with. I mean, I've never been pulled over just because I'm bored and you might do something wrong and I'm going to try to find a way to, you know, get into your car. And, you know, it could happen. And I guess I don't go down the street worrying about it, which is the biggest difference between me and people of color. I don't have to fear that, and they do, and it's wrong, and that's one of the big things we need to fix. So keep me abreast as the story develops. I'm sure you will. There's a couple of things I want to talk about that are a bit off topic and not getting much attention, but I think I'm going to be lobbing a softball to you as a libertarian. So the state of California has banned Lyft and Uber. They did this because Lyft and Uber did not want to make their, what they called contractors, into full-time employees and get benefits. Mm-hmm. So I don't know this, but I do, that the intent of that was for California to say, we're going to treat those workers with respect, and we're going to force you to do things so they're dignified and they're blah, blah, blah. Well, I used to drive for Lyft. It wasn't my full-time gig. I did it to make extra money while I was trying to start up a business. And it was great that I could set my own schedule. I'm on the clock when I want to be. I'm off the clock when I want to be. Made a few extra bucks. It got dumped into my banking account every week. I knew how much I was getting because it kept track of it. So when I was, like I said, I was trying to do a business startup, I had a pretty good nest egg, but I also was going insane when I couldn't get the business off the ground. And making 200 bucks in a night or 100 bucks in a night and doing that 4 or 5 days a week took a lot of pressure off me. And led to some interesting experiences, I can assure you. But the idea that the state of California is coming in and saying, we're going to stomp on two businesses, which, by the way, were both started in Silicon Valley. So two California-based businesses, and because you're not doing things the way we think we should for us to and we're representing the little guy out there, you're actually fucking the little guy over. You're taking away a potential for additional income from people who want to do it. It's entirely a volunteer thing. It's as a corporation, I did Lyft, but Lyft treated me very well. I mean, they sent me some promotional stuff, which who cares about that? But whenever I had a concern, I got a response quickly. Whenever my insurance was about to expire, they'd send me a note saying, hey, this is about to expire. Please make sure you take care of this. They were a well-run organization that also, in my opinion, and this is obviously pre-pandemic, does a phenomenal service for people like me and you who like to drink whiskey but don't like to drink whiskey and drive.
Yes.
I mean, exactly. I loved the fact, and now with the pandemic, it's hard to get a ride. Or not, you can still do it, but there's a lot fewer drivers out there and a lot more precautions. But, I think that the state of California, thinking they were doing the right thing for the little guy, fuck the little guy over, both the driver who wants to make a few extra bucks on the side and the consumer that wants to be able to go downtown, have a good time, and get safely home. Rant over.
I completely agree with you on this. The law, I think, is called AB5. It was an anti-gigging law, pretty much. And if I remember right, I remember when this was passed, because the big story at the time was they were basically destroying freelance photographers and journalists. And I, you know, I looked into this a little bit. Vox, they ended up firing 200 freelance writers and keeping only 12 full time because of this law. And so there's a lot of, you know, the unintended consequences of passing laws.
Right.
But here's my libertarian take on this. And this is where, you know, I usually come with a lot of things. It's the old adage, follow the money. So was California really trying to protect the little guy, or are they actually trying to generate more revenue? Because if you make these people full-time employees, then guess what? You get upfront payroll tax deductions.
Good point.
And so instead of waiting for the general contractor to pay their taxes quarterly or end of the year, however they take care of it. My wife is an independent contractor, the job she does. So I kind of understand a little bit of this. So to me, it almost seems like, okay, under the guise of we're trying to work for the little guy and get you more benefits, et cetera, actually, this is a great way for the state to generate more revenue.
That's an excellent point.
And now you end up screwing up a lot of people. So
that's an excellent point. And I'll tell you, I'm an independent consultant, and I have no taxes withheld. Typically get paid by W-9, right. And I'm supposed to file quarterly, and I don't. And at the end of the year, I pay a penalty. I think I pay it's almost $200 in penalties for not filing quarterly. But it would cost me more to file quarterly than the $200 penalty. And I'm about to sound ultra libertarian here. I like having my money until I have to give it up. So
gotta love the tax laws.
True. I mean, that's a whole different discussion. The getting rid of tax loopholes next to getting rid of gerrymandering would be probably. You know what? Campaign contribution reform just got bumped down to third. It's now a bronze medalist. I want tax reform and tax simplicity. Was it Herman Cain who said the tax code should be one page?
Basically, yeah. Okay. Yeah, he had a very simplified tax plan. I mean, a lot of Republican candidates in the past have, you know, everybody from Steve Forbes to Herman Cain most recently, just trying to very simplify the tax code. I think his plan had it on a postcard?
Maybe that's what it was.
If I remember, he had it down to basically a postcard.
He was the 999 guy, right? 9%.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
So the late Herman Cain, who, by the way, his Twitter account is still active.
Still alive.
Twitter makes you immortal, apparently.
He's all right. Jedi politician.
If you strike me down, I will come back stronger than whatever. Star Wars nerd alert. all right, man. We're about 48 minutes, and you said you want to talk about college football, and I actually watched the Memphis versus Arkansas State game in Memphis Stadium yesterday. It was on where I was out. But my last project was in Memphis, and I was thinking, well, damn, if that project hadn't fallen through and the world wasn't crazy, I could be at that game right now. So live college football was being played by two teams I didn't care about, and yet it still kind of caught my eye. Being in South Carolina, I hear football's kind of big down there.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal, especially since I'm 20 minutes down the road from Clemson, who's played in the last several playoffs here, won a couple of national titles. So it's a big college football town.
Are you a Clemson fan?
I am not. Actually a Gamecock fan. They're rival.
Okay. So, yes.
But my wife went to school at Clemson, so we have kind of the divided house thing here.
I worked in Goose Creek, South Carolina for about a year and lived in Mount Pleasant. And I have to say this, I hate Clemson because of a personal connection with a former boss who went there. I have a former boss who went there and played basketball there, and I don't like the guy. So I naturally hated Clemson and haven't come off of it. Other than him, I have yet to meet a Clemson fan that wasn't really nice. I mean, it bothers me because it's so easy to hate certain fans. Like hating a Florida fan, easy.
Right.
Easy. Hating an Alabama fan, really, really easy, because they're just in your face all the time and they are ruthless and annoying and whatever. But But everyone I've talked to who went to Clemson or cheers for Clemson has been super nice to me. And again, it kind of defeats me. So anyway, when I said it's kind of a big deal on there, I was being obviously sarcastic. But here in Ohio, Ohio State is a really big deal. And there's been players trying to get Ohio State to have an independent season, which is insane. But, I mean, you got a feel for these kids who are trying to make make the last year of college eligibility their launching pad to millions of dollars. I mean, Justin Fields, the quarterback from Ohio State, transferred here. Yep. And he, his senior year is, or will be his final year. I think he's actually a junior. But is basically been taken away from him and obviously beyond his control. But it stinks. And now it's going to potentially impact his life now with 180,000 some dead from COVID. It's hard for me to say that Justin Fields is the most victimized because he'll probably still be a high NFL draft pick, but it sucks.
It does. And I think that, and that's what's interesting, is the whole impact of COVID and the decisions going on here with college football. I think the long-term ramifications for so many. You had, I think his name's Jamie Newman, was quarterback at Georgia, just opted out of this season. And from my understanding, he had been receiving the most snaps in practice, probably would have been the starter. So here it is, you know, week, 2 weeks before their season starts, and he's decided to opt out. So you've got all kinds of things. Then you've got where the ACC, the SEC, the Big 12, all deciding to play, Big Ten and Pac-12 being the two other major conferences that have decided not to play for now, potentially could play in the spring. I think there's still some debate going on about what they want to do, but they're playing conference schedules only, these major conferences. So a lot of these small schools, like around where I live, you have schools like Coastal Carolina or Wofford, whoever, that's their big paycheck to go play again, right, with Clemson or with South Carolina. Or, we had our school, the Citadel, played Alabama, I think, 2 years ago. That's their big paycheck that funds so much of their athletic department.
Yep.
And now they're not getting that. What's going to be the long-term impact on a lot of these schools? And then just for the season itself, I think there's some really serious or very interesting stories that could come out of this, because now you've eliminated all these cupcake games.
Yeah.
So these seasons, but I think it's a 10-game season. I know for the ACC and I think SEC, it might be the same. It's going to be a real grind. So every week is going to be some real marquee games and marquee matchups coming up. And I think this could be one of the more interesting college football seasons to watch in a long time because of this. Unfortunately, we're not going to get to see teams like Ohio State and Penn State and Cal and Oregon and Southern Cal play. But
yeah. And that's a very good point, though, because, I mean, like every year before LSU and Alabama play, they each schedule a cupcake. They want to go into,
exactly,
go into that big game with essentially a scrimmage against vastly inferior talent. Most of the time. I mean, one of my favorite stories of that nature, and like you said, the big payday helps these smaller programs fund their seasons and fund their other athletic departments. When the University of Buffalo played at Ohio State, they were there to get their ass kicked and take the money. But some guy named Khalil Mack was having none of that. And he played a game that was just amazing. And I think that's what really launched him. So in addition to the schools relying on for the money, those players that didn't get into the big schools and want to make a name for themselves on a national stage and say, hey, I might play for the University of Buffalo, but here I am getting three sacks, a forced fumble, and a pick against Ohio State at Ohio State. How you like me now?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. It's an interesting thing, and it's just one of the many things that we really don't know where it's going to go. When there have been pandemics in the past, the world has been so much simpler and there's been so much less ability to communicate and get information out that no one really knew what, you didn't. I mean, I guess you would have known if football was canceled. But, it's a weird time, and I'm, going to do what I can to help get us out of it. One thing, by the way, I'm totally jumping off topic here, but one thing that's not helping us get out of it is the number of people that have suddenly made themselves simultaneously virologists and constitutional scholars. I'm a single guy. I live alone. When they reopened bars, I started going to them again. Now, yeah. I space myself out. If I walk into a place that has people just all on top of each other, I turn around and find the quiet place to sit alone. If that makes me the sad, lonely guy drinking alone at the bar, you got me. But But I can't tell you how many times I've been sitting there and someone will come up and hey, I heard that only 6,000 people died of COVID. This whole thing's bullshit. The CDC said it. Okay, that's not what they said. It's not even particularly close. But you've got this in your head now, and I have to decide, am I going to bother trying to correct you or just go, yeah, terrible, and move on? I have one guy that hangs out at my local Irish pub one time walked past me grumbling, we should go hang Bill Gates in the public square. And I'm like, okay, you're a moron.
Oh, great.
And these people are not hard to find. And they're very hard not to hear when they're on. And it's amazing how much bad information and how much general stupidity is out there. I never asked you what you were drinking, by the way.
Oh, I'm having it's Spirits of French Lick, which is a distillery in Indiana. They've become one of my favorites this year, and they've got a apple brandy that is freaking fantastic. I'm not just into whiskey. I love brandy, Calvados, cognac, rum, tequila, whatnot, different spirits to explore. But this is a two-year Asian used oak barrels. They're usually sourcing local apples from there in Indiana. And it's apparently was a huge thing, 100, 150 years ago, obviously pre-Prohibition. And Prohibition killed off a lot of that stuff. And so they're trying to revive a lot of the historical brands and things that are going on there. But Alan Bishop is the distiller there, and he is doing some absolutely amazing things with whiskey. They just released their bottled and bond, a four-grain bourbon and a high rye bourbon. And if you are in any of the states where this is available, track it down, man. Good stuff. And this brandy is amazing as well. So
cool. It's really funny to me, and I think I'm about 10 years older than you. And so I got into beer the way most kids in college. I started drinking crappy stuff to get drunk as fast as I could. And, I would drink it out of a glass, a can, a bottle, or a funnel. There was a beer called National Bohemian that we drank all the time at WVU because it was like $23 for a keg. And it was god-awful, but it got you drunk. And then I became a beer snob at a fairly young age. And when I was in grad school and in my first years as a professional, I would go out and get the craft beers. At the time it was Sam Adams and Pete's Wicked Ale and stuff like that. But to me, they were different. And they had, and I got made fun of all the, someone would be drinking a Bud Light and go, why don't you drink a man's beer? I'm like, yeah, your Bud Light's really manly. And by the way, Bud Light exists because they were trying to target the female audience during the Second World War. Anyway, so I got to watch the craft beer evolution occur. And suddenly what I was doing, I'm sounding exactly like a hipster now, but I was into it before it was cool. I started homebrewing in 1999. Now everyone homebrews. And again, I was doing it before it was cool. Now the reason I'm doing this thing is that whiskey has changed so much in the last 10 years. I mean, look how many small boutique distilleries are there out there. We've got a company in here in Cleveland called Cleveland Whiskey, and I'm going to try to hook you guys up with them, although, if being honest, I haven't sent that email yet. Sorry.
No problem.
Public confession there. Watching whiskey evolve and watching whiskey become so popular is really kind of an interesting thing to me. And seeing these, small places pop up. When I came on your show, you gave me six American craft whiskeys. I had never heard of any of them prior to trying them with you guys. So there's a lot out there to explore, which is why people should watch My Whiskey Den, because you guys talk about whiskeys and have some interesting guests on, as well as having me on. Check it out.
I'd love to have you on again sometime.
I would love that. Again, why don't you do a My Whiskey Den promo, and let's wrap this up.
Sure. So, My Whiskey Den, I have two other associates. Patrick is the one who started the channel. He's out of Wisconsin. Mike is out of Kansas City. I'm out of South Carolina, so we kind of cover the different regions that we're in. We primarily focus on craft distillers like Spirits of French Lick. Exploring different craft distilleries and what they have to offer. We're going to give honest reviews if we like it, if we don't like it, what we like about it. Mondays we do a live stream, and it's typically called an evening with. So usually we host one of these distillers or distillery owners or somebody associated with a distillery, where we'll discuss what they're doing and what they're producing. And then through the week, we'll do pre-recorded reviews of different whiskeys as well. And, you know, sometimes we'll hit Jack Daniels, or we'll do a tequila or a rum or something different. But we tend to focus on the craft side because, as you said, there was a craft whiskey boom, as there's been a worldwide whiskey explosion, really, right, in the last 10 years. But there's also been a huge explosion in craft distillers. A lot of these guys are getting some age on them, so their product is becoming very good and very interesting. And right now with the COVID, the pandemic, the way it's hit, I would encourage anybody out there, go, if you can visit, go visit. If not, at least buy the product, your local craft distillers, because this is impacting them big time. And we could see up to a 30% closure of these guys by the time this is all said and done.
Wow. So, you know, you mentioned the whiskey boom, but there's also, you know, risk of a whiskey shortage. In fact, people say it's already here. Yeah. So I mentioned Cleveland whiskey.
Yeah,
one thing that's cool about Cleveland whiskey is they use a sped up aging process. That's cool for a bunch of reasons. One, you get whiskey more quickly, but two, and this is something that their owner, when Steve and I sat down with them, said, when they try out a new product, it's ready. It's, let's say they age it and it takes 6 months for them to make a whiskey that would normally be a 6 or 7 year whiskey.
Yeah.
If they make a whiskey that's good in 6 months, they can be putting that out on the market. If you're making a 7 year whiskey and it's fantastic, but you're doing it on a small scale because you want to see how it turns out before you mass produce. So it took you 6 years or 7 years to age it. So now, hey, it's great. Let's do this again. Great. It'll be on the shelves in 7 years. And so the ability to for your product to evolve, and I think, and I'm not trying to be a homer here, but I kind of am, but I've noticed an evolution in Cleveland whiskey. And a big part of that is because they've been around for about 5 years now, I think. And, you know, so they've gone through that many more cycles, whereas, like I said, a 7 year whiskey would take 7 years to develop it and find out it's good, and then 7 years to get it on the shelves. And I'm not that patient.
Yeah, that's always been part of the problem that's plagued a lot of distillers. You know, there's things they do to try to work around that. Sometimes it's sourcing, sometimes it's making vodka and gin, which, you know, they can turn around quickly and be able to sell.
A lot of these places are making hand sanitizer
traditionally,
now.
Traditionally, it's just been a very slow process. And I've heard it said, you know, if you want to make money, you don't become a distiller or you don't open a distillery.
Right.
It's going to take you a long time to turn a profit. So,
I got to tell you, I think I might have told you this the other day. If I didn't, if I'm repeating myself, I apologize. But when I was on your show, I talked about how Old Crow was my go-to whiskey as a grad student because it was cheap and I could.
Yes.
Did I tell you I tried it again the other day?
Did you? No, you haven't.
Oh my God, it's bad. I drank it, and I don't want to insult the people who make Old Crow because you got me through grad school. But I was at a bar with a friend, and their whiskeys were half priced, and I said, well, you know what? I see Old Crow on here. I talked about it on a podcast the other day, meaning my whiskey den, and my friend looked at me like, what are you doing? And the bartender told me, well, that one's not half price because it's already only $3. So we're not selling you whiskey for $1.50. and I drank it. And I'm like, wow. I literally tried to sip it and treat it like it was a whiskey that deserved respect, but it became a shooter real fast.
Yeah. That was one for me, college, that around that time, that was me and my buddies. That was our poker game, poker night whiskey. Set a bottle on the table, play poker till the bottle was gone. You know, drank a lot of Old Crow then. I still have it on occasion. I usually keep a bottle around because for an $8, $9 bottle of whiskey, which it usually is around here, it's really not terrible.
I agree.
But yeah, it's not great either.
No, it's not. You know, again, I would buy it again. So I 10 High is my go-to cheap whiskey.
Sure.
I also do Heaven Hill, and those are very, very reasonably priced. And if I'm making a Manhattan, you know, I just assume not use a fancy whiskey. Yeah, I would make a Manhattan with Old Crow, but trying to sip on it as if it were Lafroig or Lagavulin or Angel's Envy, that was not happening.
Right.
All right, man. Thank you so much for coming on. I enjoyed the talk as usual. We will definitely have you back. Your show is at 9 p.m. tonight, typically on Monday. It's stored on their YouTube channel, which is My Whiskey Den. Talk to you soon, brother.
That's right. Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, we're out.